Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. I am your host, John Brooks, and I would like to welcome you if you're new to this podcast. And if you've already listened to this podcast before, I'd like to welcome you back. We've been having some great reviews and comments on the previous podcasts. The last one was with Laura Dawn. We went very deep into the visionary archetype. So if you haven't been keeping up to date with previous episodes, then give them a listen. And if you do like these episodes, we would love to hear from you. You can leave us a comment who you'd like us to talk to. You can leave a review. At High Existence, we really value community and interaction. So we would love to hear from you. In today's episode, we speak to Justin Knopp, who is a learning expert. Justin, from a young age, was always smart but disillusioned with the way things were being taught at schools. So he strove to figure out the patterns that make successful learners different from unsuccessful learners. After graduating, he went on to become a language teacher for over 15 years, where he further developed his systems for decoding and comprehending skills and practices. Out of all of that experience, Justin has mastered the skill of learning skills, which is an amazing meta skill that many of us could benefit from learning more about. Learning how to learn is perhaps the most important piece of the puzzle that will save us a lot of time and frustration. This is a 2-hour conversation where we go very, very deep into topics like deep learning versus shallow learning, data acquisition versus skill acquisition, how we can read properly and improperly, the issues of cramming, how memory works. Justin goes into depth on how we should think about artistic talent versus a developed skill. We talk about martial arts and the strategies for learning physical processes like jiu-jitsu or gymnastics or anything physical. We talk about the optimum number of times to drill something or repeat something. Also, how to categorize consumption practices and stillness practices and productive practices to create the perfect morning routine. How to actually think for yourself and not just be a walking collection of quotes. Justin shares his favorite books. Each of these books, he said he's read over 7 times. So these are his favorite books of all time by far. I love learning. I love systems. So you get to hear me picking Justin's brain in this episode. And if you like learning too, then I'm sure you will get a lot of value out of this interview. Without further ado, Justin Knopp. So I want to zoom out for a minute. And I just want to ask you, what are you an expert in compared to the average person?
Okay. The easiest way to answer that is I'm a learning expert. With compared to normal people, I'm very specialized in data and information, how to break it down and how to piecemeal it into the brain in sizable chunks for an individual. And then going further into that, what that looks like inside the brain, how each mechanism works, what are the common misunderstandings and myths that come along with learning in the brain. And then a couple of subject matters that come with that as well, like language is a typical one, but anything else like, the memory championships, these types of data points that people normally ooh and ah about, which aren't actually such big deals in real life, really. But they're still quite impressive party tricks. Anything else, like I help a lot of postgraduates with facilitating their particular study methods a little bit better.
So you specialize in learning. Would that include every single type of learning, or is there like a subset within learning in a general sense that you tend to thrive with?
I'm not too sure I understand the question. What do you mean with different types of learning?
So like maybe we should define what learning is, but like for example, if someone is loses the ability to walk and they want to learn how to walk again, for example. Mm-hmm. That's very different from learning a language.
Got it. Okay, yeah. So really what we're talking about here is skill acquisition. And so when we talk about learning, most people think about books, but actually books is the facilitation of data to then make it a skill. So when data can come to you without you actually thinking about it, much like when you learn a language, initially you have to study grammar and vocabulary and you have to put a lot of information in your brain. But after a while, it actually becomes a skill, and that skill develops. And that's really what we call true learning or deep learning. That's when you don't need to think about it. You can just do it. It's that automatic learning. So think about, I think the best way to connect it with people is think about driving a car. The first time that you get in a car and you have to learn how to drive that particular, whatever it is, automatic or manual, there's a certain number of pieces of information that you need to take in and operate at the same time and balance. But, you know, whether it's been checking your rearview mirrors, checking your blind spots, indicating, changing gears, clutch control, whatever, you know, pedals that you need to operate. But then after 6 months, you're able to do that without even thinking. You're able to then also drink coffee at the same time, you know, have full-on conversations about business, whatever it may be. Your brain has actually integrated all of that information into a particular skill. So even if you're learning to walk again, people take that for granted, you know, like, oh, I know how to walk. No. You grew up with this skill and not thinking about it. There was no conscious effort to actually acquire the skill. And so when you, let's say you have an accident, you have to relearn how to walk, like your muscles atrophy. You have to learn how to connect to all those muscles again. It's all the same pathways. Your neuromuscular system is all connected. When you go back to the brain, even learning a language can be learned faster by using the brain's natural pathways like movement. So sitting in a, you know, sitting down and studying with a book in front of you is one of the worst things that I would recommend people do, because it slows down your entire body, your system. You get bored, your body gets bored. Physically, you have these symptoms of boredom. Your heart slows, you start to get drowsy because of the lack of oxygen going into your brain. Your breathing is shallow and weak, and you know, basically what we've done is we've told the physical part of our brain that this is time now for rest, but we're expected to perform mentally. And so when I talk about learning, I'm talking about the acquisition of skills that utilize our nervous system, our actual brain. And everybody thinks that the muscles are different, but actually the brain controls the muscles. Your brain will tell your muscles to contract, to relax. The amount of neurons that fire when you learn complex movements like dancing, things like that. That is true coordination. All of these things fit together to be able to show what true learning is. And there's a couple of stages to this. The first experience of data, but then after that, the deconstruction and the deeper processing of data, and then the rehearsal of data so that it becomes automatic, and how long that process takes. And there's a lot of little sub-skills within there, a lot of little small muscles that we can all exercise. I'm sure we all know people and ourselves that are very good at certain aspects of learning over others, but a lot of that is also conditioned into us. Number one, conditioned into our belief system that's how learning works. And then number two, also conditioned into us in that, how did we survive our own high school or university experience? A lot of it was, well, oh, I just had to do this. Or my favorite one is of course the cramming sessions. You cram the night before, you just reread your notes so many times, and it just goes into your short-term memory loop long enough for you to actually successfully write an exam. And then 2-3 days later, when that short-term memory kind of storage capacity is cleared out, you can't recall anything, and you sometimes marvel at how you even passed that exam.
I've had that experience. So I really want to go very deep with you into some of the aspects of learning. But before I do that, I'm quite curious how you ended up choosing this the subject to sort of figure out and master. So how can you take us back to like how you kind of came to be?
Sure. This way? Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's got one of these stories of you strive to become the person that you needed most when you were developing. And so for me, I was always smart, but learning was a difficult task, especially the way that it was presented at school. And I just saw it was ineffective. And so starting small investigations and always been interested in small things like that when I was young. And then you fast forward a couple of years and I found myself doing what I really enjoyed, which was teaching languages. And I climbed the ranks, you know, in the schools, becoming a senior teacher, getting all the relevant qualifications, getting all the relevant experience. And it culminated with two things. I got my master's degree in applied linguistics and language education. And I also spoke at a few international teacher conferences. And when I was trying to point out what some of the current issues were or how we as teachers could influence publishers to actually change the system and things like that, I just realized that I was speaking to a room of people that that didn't have aligned interests with me, which is when I decided, okay, cool. I need to realize that the industry that I'm embedded in, it doesn't have the same value system or the same principles that I do. Where a lot of people will say, oh, you want to learn a language? That's great. Just put in 2 hours a day at a school every day for 3 years and you'll get there. Where I actually believe with the right mix of methodology, the right mix of materials, you can get from zero to fluent within 3 to 6 months, depending on how much effort you put in, focused quality processing and rehearsal. You could get there very quickly. And so basically going on this evolution of, well, I needed somebody to show me how learning worked, to then being involved in learning and educating people for over, what was it now, 14 years, 15 years? Mm-hmm. And just seeing the standard that's out there and just knowing that I could do better and I could get better out of people as well. And so, yeah, that's been my journey, really. You know, and investigating all these different aspects have taken just a, you know, small divergence from that little journey as well. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was kind of curious, as I was thinking as you were telling your story, about some people, they just tend to love learning and they are highly motivated to learn, and they might not have the optimal strategies, right? But they just love to just absorb information, you know, the type of person to carry notebook around. Like, to me, that seems to be like a very important factor in learning, is just that kind of motivation to learn. I'm just trying to think, like, how with the learning strategies that you teach, if someone is already very motivated to learn, how much quicker or deeper could they learn if they had your strategies on top?
So it's actually quite interesting, because ultimately what it comes back to is also knowledge of self. The way that our brains are wired and designed, we are, I love this. I was actually speaking to, obviously, Eric of High Existence, and him and I were talking about this, about how man is a, what is it? He said, a socio-psycho-bio-organism. And I thought that was a beautiful way of saying it. You know, it's very scientific. And for me, it was on the money. The way that our brains are wired, we are wired to be in a social group to find social value. We are wired to be emotional over rational. Our emotions serve us in compelling a social group, you know, and standing our, you know, like with our value and our standing inside a social group as well. And our identities are defined according to these things. And taking all of these natural ways of how the brain actually works and functions best, and then mixing them with how people have actually learned to use their own personal mechanisms, and blending that together is really the art and science. It's kind of like, you know, nutrition. Everybody's got their own developed preferences or developed allergies or intolerances as well. And we don't necessarily have an optimal for everybody based on diet. We've got a good idea of what is great and what is poor diet. you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. And we have principle-based diets, but then we can specialize our diets. Now, that depends on regions of the world. That depends on, like, you know, different makeups. You know, does your ethnicity actually feed into it versus your conditioning, your culture, your the regions where you are, where your ancestors were? That goes a lot deeper. The brain is a lot easier to kind of diagnose because it just comes back to, well, everyone's brain is functioned around being social. Everyone's brain is functioned around these things, but we still have to match the individual's journey to what is the optimum function. So the people who walk around with like books and notepads and things like that, and they love learning, they're already practiced. And so the easiest way to understand it is that we've got different muscles. We don't have tendencies. We don't have natural abilities. We just have muscles. That's it. Everybody's got it. And just like memory, people say, oh, I've got a bad memory. It's like, no. You have a poorly exercised memory muscle. And even then, it's like, oh, I remember numbers, but I don't remember names. Oh, so your numbers muscle is well exercised, but your name muscle isn't so well exercised. Well, that's fine. As long as you take, number one, that initial attitude of, it's a muscle, it's not me, it's not my identity, it's a muscle that I can exercise. And just like muscles in the gym or wherever, you can only compare yourself to yourself. Unless you're competing, there's no point of saying, I am bad and everyone else is good at this. And so taking that first approach to it is key. And then after that, you start to go and dig deeper into these types of, okay, cool, well, how do I exercise this muscle? What does a program to exercise this muscle look like? And how quickly can I actually get it to a place where I can consider it a strength instead of a weakness, or consider my strength to be now a defining quality of who I am? And so it's just that simple matter of, like, your body will get better at whatever it is you tell it to do. So if you tell your body, okay, cool, brain, we're going to memorize numbers, then your brain initially will have some problems with it as you've never really exercised that muscle before, but eventually it'll get so efficient that it'll be a defining quality, you know, if you choose to let it be that thing. Like, for example, doing a Rubik's Cube. A lot of people are like, wow, I could never do a Rubik's Cube. It's for geniuses. I talk to people all the time about the Rubik's Cube because initially, we're conditioned to believe that a Rubik's Cube is only for smart or genius people, or it's some kind of like hardcore skill to learn. And then when you get past it, when you ask them, like, really, but there's only 5 sequences that I can show you, and it would just require, let's say, an hour of practice a day for a week. And you could split that up and you could do half an hour of practice for 2 weeks, or you could split that up and you could do 15 minutes of practice for 4 weeks. When you just, when you know, present it to people like that and you show them it's an achievable skill, the question is, where do you want to stop? Not do you want to start or can you do it? It's like, well, how far do you want to go? Do you want to be the kid who breaks the world record and get to like 6-second Rubik's Cube solves? Because that's when you start to think about it like an Olympic level athlete, where it's all you do is train this, versus, oh no, I think if I can get it under a minute, that would be a great party trick. Or if I could get it under 3 minutes while I'm presenting on stage and doing this at the same time. Like, the effect of that is much stronger than, oh, I completed a Rubik's Cube in under 10 seconds. You know, if you do it in front of people while, let's say, you're presenting on stage, that's an incredible social, let's say social currency. So, yeah. It gets quite intricate. And so those people walking around with those notepads and pens, you can always evolve their skills because everybody's got a certain amount of musculature. But just like people who are average, who don't necessarily walk around like that, you know, first step is exercising their attitude of like, well, I can do this and I can learn about anything. And the key is really finding a social aspect and an emotional aspect to motivate people. And after that, I mean, they just love it and they'll do it anyway by themselves.
On this this point of muscles, you know, like skill sets being like muscles, I'm curious to hear your take on like natural talent, or sort of IQ, you know, that kind of base level talent for something versus hard work and sort of focused study. Do you have any thoughts on the, like, you know, do you think that like talent is real? Do you think that we can acquire like expert talent, or any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So initially, straight off the bat, I've got three things which come up from that question. The first of which is that, like, IQ as a measurement is largely overemphasized. Initially, IQ tests were actually made to identify weaknesses, not strengths, not to identify the strong people or the smarter people, but actually the people who needed more assistance, the people who were lagging behind, who perhaps didn't have developed reasoning, pattern recognition, things like that. So societies like Mensa, you know, where people identify themselves as, oh, I'm in the smartest 2%, okay, I actually find that those types of things, identifying yourself as high IQ, actually has the opposite effect of what you want, where you've got a lot of data that suggests that people who have over, let's say, 130 points on IQ, I think the number is 130, it might be 135, but after that, higher IQ actually starts to be a problem, where humans as a group, we are social, and therefore, like, success is not necessarily tied to intelligence. It's actually tied to how we relate to others, how we can empathize with others, how we can actually connect with others. You know, team building. One of my favorite movies to emphasize, like, a great role model is The Wizard of Oz. Like, Dorothy, in that, she has no particular skills other than empathy and team leading. And that's all that she does. She doesn't actually do anything else. Everyone else does the stuff, and all they do is they take the journey together, and it's successful. And I think that that's a great, you know, a great emphasis on social intelligence. But, you know, so number one was this metric of IQ. Number two is then this idea that social intelligence, just like emotional intelligence. You've read the book EQ, Emotional Intelligence?
I read the social intelligence one, not
right.
The
emotional. Yeah. So he actually came out with another book called Personal Intelligence, which if we define intelligence in certain ways, then we'll see who is or is not intelligent. But this personal intelligence, like a police officer who's been a cop for 20 years has a certain level of intelligence and intuition about these personalized experiences that he has, which call together a culmination of all of these muscles in his brain that he's learnt of doing this thing again and again and again that makes him highly specialized. And that is a type of intelligence that you cannot replicate. And so a chef, a baker. And so the Chinese actually define this as gong fu. So it's traditionally we think of kung fu as, you know, these things of martial arts and like flying kicks and haya. But actually the terminology like gong fu translates as developed practice, developed skill. And so a baker can have gong fu, a developed skill, you know. And so I think my third thing is, why would anyone want to define themselves as intelligent, where it seems to defeat the purpose, where curiosity, defining, the more people know, the more they start to say, oh, well, I know this, therefore I don't need to learn more. I don't need to learn more about this particular thing. And so I'll introduce a concept of breadth versus depth of knowledge, which becomes really, really exciting when you think about it, where if I've studied a little bit of everything, and a lot about one particular topic, which is my specialization, it becomes very easy for me to, number one, relate to new information that I find, but also number two is then I get excited about it because I have that little bit of knowledge about everything. And then also take inspiration from that and bring it into my own field. So something that I saw recently, I don't know if you're familiar with wind thermals?
No.
So, like, you take a big bird, like a condor or an eagle, something that's huge, like a vulture, very, very, very big bird. What they actually do is they ride these air thermals, these wind thermals, these rising whirlpools of, like, hot air, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how gliders, paragliders, hang gliders, they all fly on these wind thermals. They will ride this thermal high into the air, and then they will glide for a far distance until they hit the next thermal. You take that aspect and you connect it to, you know, clean energy. At the moment, we've got a big call for clean energy. And one of the biggest contributors to the global climate change and climate crisis is actually airplanes and how airplanes are so cheap and everyone's flying everywhere. And these guys down in like a university in San Diego were developing a program where a plane or a glider could actually read the thermals and adjust. And so you can now imagine that these huge airplanes like climb using this technology. They can climb thermals and glide for miles without having to use fuel. And therefore, like your flights might become a little bit longer, but your energy consumption just goes down, drops down. I think they were talking about like an 80% a reduction on fuel usage. And you just get excited about this type of stuff because maybe you're passionate about climate change, or you're passionate about animals and big birds, or you're passionate about the science of wind thermals. You know, there's so many different things, and bringing these topics together really allows you to relate all of this together and then draw inspiration into your own thing. Like, okay, cool, how can I take inspiration from nature or use naturally occurring things for me to be able to you know, further my own interests? Like, oh, I want to exercise. Cool. How does nature actually help me exercise? How does my environment help me exercise or facilitate this in my life, where it's actually not difficult for me to push against my environment, but rather work in harmony with my environment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so that covers like some views you have on like the downsides to IQ and kind of labeling yourself or seeking to be thinking of yourself as intelligent. What about, though, like if you look at the Renaissance period, there was a group of artists, you know, Leonardo, Michelangelo, Raphael, and they all definitely like studied hardcore from a young age. They all had apprenticeships, but some seem to have stood out as being better than others. Do you think that they were just like naturally better at learning, or like I'm just curious on your kind of view on that kind of artistic talent.
Yeah. I think when you put it into the model of how the brain works, there's a part like after you've done all the deeper processing of information, you've got rehearsal. So a lot of people talk about art and creativity as being a spontaneous thing. I don't have those kind of views. For me, art is more of a developed practice as well. Like you can be truly artistic, but have zero developed skill. And you can be zero creativity but have a developed skill as well. Now, if some of the famous painters, I think it was Monet, I don't know, there are multiple examples, if you go and research it, of whatever you think is your the most creative painter that you can imagine, or someone who was very spontaneous, and you actually research them, you'll find that they did hundreds of hours developing a skill in a particular thing. And so like you're saying, they did apprenticeships, they did this, they did that. They were talented, they started with good skills. And I think this is something I wanted to say about IQ as well, which makes it irrelevant, which is a little parable that somebody told me about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The one guy comes in to a teacher and says, I want to get a black belt. How long will it take me? The teacher tests him out and says, wow, you have a real talent for this. You are naturally developed for this type of thing. I think if you came in for 1 hour a day, 4 days a week for 6 months, you will get your black belt. And the guy says, that's too much time. I'm sorry, no. And he doesn't put in the time, the effort. He doesn't get the black belt. He just decides to move on to something else. Now, with regard to the next guy comes in and the master teaches him, tests him, and he says, wow, you have zero talent for this. So it's going to take you 3 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 years for you to get your black belt. But this particular individual, we'll call him Paul for no apparent reason, Paul's commitment, his determination is so strong that he actually just bulls through all of that work and gets it done. And his motivation and his discipline is actually the defining factor to his skill development. And if Paul met up with that first guy, he would absolutely wipe the floor with him because he has a developed skill versus that natural talent. And so when we talk about like Renaissance painters and things like that, it's much in the same vein, where did these people just have a natural talent, or were they in the right place to have the right apprenticeships with the right amount of motivation and then discipline to be able to develop that type of skill and then be in the right places amongst the right people to then have inspiration to create certain things out of their developed skill as well.
Hmm. You know, it's quite a synchronicity that you gave that parable, because one of the things I wanted to actually ask you about in this conversation was about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because I've actually just came back before this call from a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class. I've been studying this art for maybe about a year and a half, and I find that this art is very interesting because first of all, there are so many techniques to learn. Mm. So like there's like learning the techniques, understanding the techniques. Then there's the kind of like embodying them. So it's not enough to kind of like know them. You have to actually like physically know them. Mm. And then on top of that, you have to be able to do them in a real situation with an opponent who wants to stop you from doing that, and like overcome that opponent. And they say like a black belt on average can take 10 to 15 years to get. And I'm very fascinated how you would take that sort of, it's kind of like a very, lots of high level thinking and intelligence, and also like that physical side, and how you could help someone learn the art of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or any kind of like complicated martial art for that matter in an accelerated way. Do you have any like ideas or tips on that?
It's very interesting that you asked me this question, because I used to actually teach a martial art. It was called the Yin style swimming body 8-trigram palm. I actually think I'm missing a couple of things. I don't know. It's been close to 6 years since I left this particular style. Mm. And it is a very complex martial art. And I've always been attracted to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because of its complexity as well. I really enjoy martial arts that function on like a higher cognitive level as well. Surprise, surprise, mm. You know. And so something like this, we can take it as an example to run through your actual model of learning. And so the first thing that you need to establish is that you need to see a certain amount of it. You need to feel a certain amount of it. Like the brain has got specific neurons called mirror neurons. Now, if anyone's unfamiliar with that, it's just very simple. When you see someone doing something, the same neural pathways light up in your brain as if you were doing that particular action yourself, but to a much reduced intensity. And so lighting up those neurons is a great way to start. But then what we do with anything is we start with a particular principle in mind. And so principles of things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, the first question is it gi or no gi? And then after that, it's like, okay, well, what are we operating on? If we're talking about getting into a lock versus a choke, and so you start to understand fulcrum dynamics. And understanding that means that you initially are exposed to a lot of techniques, but it becomes your responsibility to actually boil these techniques down and reduce them down to like their core quality. And the core quality is usually going to be your fulcrum dynamics, your principles of getting into and moving out of certain positions. So it's not actually the final position that makes it important, but rather the movement into the final position. Because the final positions initially are easy to see. Oh, I just need to put this person's arm in between my legs, hold on to their wrist, and then their elbow would be on my stomach, and I can get them into that arm bar. But how do I actually move into that position? Well, there's multiple ways. And why do those multiple ways exist? And so you've got these fundamental principles. Initially, your best course of action would be to find, let's say, 10 techniques which exemplify completely different strategies to get into that one position. Like let's say one of them, you've got the mount position, the other one, you've got the guard position, you know, you're on the bottom, you're on the top. So you play with all of these variables. You have these independent variables that you're going to manipulate. A larger opponent, a smaller opponent, these could all be your variables. And then what I would do is train them. Much like if you're training football, you would train a skill like ball control. And I would repeat that. Now, a lot of the research shows us that to develop a skill so that it's automatic will take us a certain amount of time, let's say a period of 2 weeks of training it. And so we build up to over 100 repetitions. And that would be the cleanest, purest technique with no deviation from that particular thing so that you can just flow without thinking. After that, I would start to introduce integration, which is, let's imagine, ball control into shooting at the goals. So it's the same thing. We integrate, let's say, we go for a classic attacking position. I'm on top, you're in the guard position, and I pass the guard and get you into an armbar. Great, okay? And then we integrate it into, okay, I do this, but then you resist the armbar and I have to either dig in deeper or I have to then switch it up into get you into, let's say, a headlock or something like that. Mm-hmm. Integrating some type of flow. And then after that, what you do is you introduce certain amounts of stress for you to be able to overcome those particular things. So let's say your stresses are going to be that you're not starting in a perfect position. But your stresses, most people think that that's how a skill is formed. But skill is usually formed by doing at least 80% of the isolated skill work where you're focusing on that clean technique, and also your 20% of stress-stimulated, what's known as scrimmage, where it's basically you're trying to copy or simulate a real life experience, but without those hardcore consequences of, let's say, breaking your arm or losing consciousness. And so what Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, from what I've seen from most people who train it in a lot of the gyms that I've been in, and of course I haven't been in every single gym or dojo or, you know, rolling mats in the world, so I don't know your particular environment, but a lot of people, they train scrimmage more than anything else, and weighting it and weighting those ratios of like, well, how much of that consistent practice do you do where it's just clean and pure versus how much do you do with scrimmage? And a good example would be to actually get people to drill these things without a partner first, like on a dummy or just imagining and visualizing, and then flowing with a partner, and then removing the partner and adding the partner and removing the partner, and then doing that kind of a rolling practice where you're trying to do an armbar and your partner is just trying to play the role of that person in that armbar. And what you do is you start to develop feeling. Rather than going, okay, first I need to do this, then I need to do this, then I need to do this, your brain will start to automate that process. And what will happen is you'll notice when you're past that point, and eventually you'll get to a point where you're rather dealing with smaller intricacies like, oh, this person's stronger. Okay, let me do this to adjust. And so the minor adjustments come in at a later stage in the game. Once you've got your general shape of movement, minor adjustments come in. And those minor adjustments are where the successes come in. And I will guarantee that anyone of high level will tell you that they will be able to get you into an armbar every single time. Like, they will say, okay, we're going to roll for 15 minutes and I'm only allowed to do this one movement. And it doesn't matter what you do, I will be able to get you into that lock every single time. And that's one of the most debilitating things a martial artist can do, is tell you how they're going to checkmate you. And yeah, there's nothing that you can do to resist it. And that is a true high level of skill. You know, when people sucker punch you, that's not necessarily a high level of skill. That's a good use of environment and timing and distraction. And these are ways that we can get around bigger opponents, stronger opponents, more experienced opponents. We can feed into that type of psychology. We can go into that realm. But for developing skill, That is true skill development, is the ability to say, I am going to do this and I want you to stop me doing this, and I find ways around it that's not brute force solutions but more elegant solutions, like finding those rhythms, those it's very difficult for me to talk about martial arts without actually demonstrating it, but like those turns, those sweet spots in the muscle where you can actually deviate their opposing force and then overcome that.
So there are two things there that I would love for you to, very interesting ideas that I'd like you to get some more clarification on. So the first one is, what would be the benefit of drilling with a demi or solo instead of always drilling with a partner, because that's something almost like nobody that I know does that. But I'm just curious what would be the benefit of that. And then to follow up with that, how many repetitions of a particular move would be the ideal before sort of moving on to something else, in your opinion? Okay.
Okay, so let's start with the first question. Obviously, a lot of my background is also with language acquisition. And so if I told you that speaking is a skill, 90% of your speaking practice should be alone. People are like, what? Why would you speak alone? Surely speaking needs a partner. And it's not the idea of the partner being there to offer you feedback or resistance. It's more the idea of, for you to speak, for you to produce anything, whether it be movement of your mouth to produce words, or whether it be coordination of your body in order to facilitate that final lock, you need to balance a certain amount of working memory. And working memory, for anyone who's unfamiliar with the term, working memory is basically your information management system in your brain, where you like, oh, okay, we're doing this now, let's bring that memory out and let's put it into the body, let's facilitate that. So it's the communication between your body and your brain of how to do something. And so in the beginning, if I teach you Japanese, something like watashi wa nihongo ga umaku hanasu koto ga dekimasen, you're like, oh my gosh, that's so big. That's because your working memory is limited to a certain number of slots. And so if I just said watashi wa, you're like, oh, that's much easier. It's limited, it's smaller. I have enough working memory slots to be able to work this. So, I mean, it's an abstract notion, but approximately 5 to 7 slots, let's say. I would even be more conservative and say 3 to 5 slots per person. And so if I ask you to repeat that phrase while balancing a pencil on your finger, you would actually stop speaking Japanese to focus on balancing. And then when the balance is sure, that's when you would start focusing on Japanese again. And you would see your brain unable to multitask and flip between these two states. And that's why we talk about this thing that there is no such thing as multitasking, but there's just quick switching between two different two different focuses. And so if we take that into mind and we talk about training, when you are training alone without a partner, what you are doing is facilitating this memory retrieval system and memory activation in your physical body. And so I tell people 90% of your speaking practice should be alone, because then if you practice the conversation of, let's say, going into a coffee shop and ordering a coffee, or speaking and doing the where are you from conversation in a language, if you practice that 90% on your own, by the time you go into a coffee shop and practice it, you will be part of my French, but you'll be fed. I was going to swear, and then I'm thinking maybe it's not a good idea that I swear on a podcast. But you'll be fantastic. You'll be, you'll be amazing, and you'll feel confident. It'll have such an impact on your confidence. It'll be incredible, and that confidence obviously puts you into a different state of being as well, where you will start to believe that you can do it, which is an amazing thing as well. Instead of being insecure in your movements, you'll take fewer risks and you'll get fewer rewards for it and experience fewer victories as a result. And so drilling on your own, you're facilitating this memory retrieval, this reconstruction of what it is that you're doing, and drilling that and then putting a partner with it on the final 10% allows you to put those shapes into context. Context is really what's missing. So if I teach you a phrase in a language, using it is the biggest problem, finding a context for it. But if you only focus on context and you don't focus on retrieving that information, and then retrieving that information again with a little bit of stress, and then retrieving that information again with a little bit more stress, then by the time it comes to contextualization, your brain is so bothered of like, where do I put this? Where does it come from? Or, oh my gosh, I'm in this context. What do I do now? So it takes time for the brain to be able to process this. And you could do it with just a brute force amount of hours rolling on the mat, a brute force amount of hours speaking a language. You will eventually get there. But there are definitely ways to make that process a lot more elegant and efficient. And so you asked about the number. What is the number? So as you can imagine, you know, there's a lot of people out there talking. Malcolm Gladwell was talking about the 10,000 hours rule. The 10,000 hours rule, the research that's come out with that as well is actually shown that there's more value in having a certain amount of hours across a breadth of different disciplines, and then afterwards specializing in one. And then so developing depth out of your breadth of knowledge. And so even then, I would say Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but then cross-training with other things and cross-training with other things, but specializing in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu will have major impacts in your ability to learn faster. Now, if you want to just talk about, okay, purely forget the cross-pollination effect, let's talk about purely training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. How many hours? Let's say, how many repetitions for just one armbar technique? There was an interesting study done showing that you needed between 70 to 100 repetitions of something before it became automatic. Now, the caveat to this is that it depends on the individual with regard to how much of that is focused practice. So if somebody's a newbie and they're not sure about particular movements, they haven't got experience in particular movements, it'll take them to the higher end of that range. And also, if they're not practiced at focusing on every little specific thing, maybe they don't see the point. Like, why do I need to think about where my thumb is when I do particular grips or holds? Like, if you do no-gi rolling, you have to practice a particular grip. Otherwise, you're in danger of, like, you know, getting your fingernails pulled off because the gi and the way that you grip it could be dangerous if you've got, like, slightly, like, unkempt fingernails. So thinking about things and focusing to that degree, it takes practice. So if I've got somebody who's got 2 years of training and someone who's got 2 months of training, the number of repetitions that they would need with a new skill would be very different because of their past experience and because of their muscles of acquiring that data. And so I would say for the newbies, you're looking at least doubling that range to have a good developed skill. And the final thing that I'll say on this is that most people think about this with regard to sheer quantity, and it's not got to do with sheer quantity. It's actually got to do with quality. And as soon as that quality drops, sleep. Sleep.
Okay. Yeah. Could you elaborate more on the sleep?
Why that is so useful? Think about it like this. If you go into the gym, 7 days a week, and you've got, let's say, 10 hours, you know, your personal trainer says, I want you to spend 10 hours in the gym this week. If you separate it to like an hour and a half a day over, you know, 6 to 7 days or whatever, you're going to get your time, 2 hours a day in the gym, 5 days a week. Great, you're going to get your 10 hours. But imagine somebody who has no time during the week and then just spends 10 hours on a Saturday in the gym. Or even 5 hours on Saturday, 5 hours on Sunday, you're going to get very different results. And so spreading things out over time is a much better thing to do, especially when somebody's got an unfocused mind. They haven't exercised that focus muscle as much. Nowadays, we talk about it like all these studies are coming out saying that our attention span, our ability to focus is less than that of a goldfish. And that's a big deal when you think about it. We've got, you know, the age of social media where we're always distracted all the time. We can't get really down to deep work. But it's you know, people talk about it in such a dire way. It's just that, well, we've engineered our environment to be like this. It's not going to be like that forever. We can easily take control of it at any point in time and just develop it back up. It's not a problem. It's not something that you can lose. That's like saying, like, oh, you know, your hair that you've got now, well, it's going to change and be, you know, fruit next year. It doesn't work like that. It's just impossible. You know, it's just scaremongering or a way to kind of get people riled up about something. It's a lot less scary than you think. Oh, the crows are calling me. I love crows. They're my spirit totem. They tell me that I'm on the right path. So obviously talking to you today, John, is a very good thing. Sleep. Sleep basically is what you need to develop. So anyone who goes to the gym, who exercises, you know that when you go to the gym, what you're doing is you're breaking down muscle. With good nutrition, you feed the regrowth. But good nutrition doesn't grow muscles. Sleep allows you to grow and repair. And it's the same thing with your mind, with your nervous system and your neural networks. When you are learning something, what happens is a chemical change. Now, when you repeat that chemical change over time, it'll slowly start connecting stronger and stronger and stronger neurons together. And eventually, those neurons will grow together into like a much strengthened, neural highway. So every time you walk along a certain road, that road goes from a field to a dirt road, a walked path, to a wider path of sand, to then, okay, fine, now we've got tarmac, and then we build 2 lanes, then 4 lanes, then 6 lanes, and eventually we've got like a super highway. And that's how our neural pathways develop. The more we practice something, the more they're like, okay, cool, we've got traffic along this road, let's shore it up, let's make it stronger. So it's the same thing, but that development, that road work only happens when you sleep. It doesn't happen when you're awake. And so once you've reached the end of quality, take a break, go into that diffuse mode, allow your brain to just settle, and you can go straight into sleep if you want to, because that sleep will help it diffuse as well. So you have to flit between these focus modes and diffuse modes, where it just goes in and you trust your brain to do its own thing, because that's ultimately what you're trying to develop, is that your brain does these things without your focused deliberate thought, that it becomes something that's just automatic in your life.
Gotcha. That's a really useful tip to, as you say, go into that diffuse mode and then sleep if that's an option. After you learn something.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, going further on the topic of sleep, you know, we're in this kind of age now where some people they think that, you know, they want to try and be awake for as long as possible, and, you know, go 4 hours or 6 hours a night and sleep. Do you think that would just like greatly impact someone's learning if they were kind of chronically sleep deprived or like drinking way too much caffeine? Like, what are your thoughts on just general like sleep habits and learning?
I think the beginning of it is that I'm a pragmatist. I mean, you've got to be practical about these things. If you work a certain job and you want a gym and you want to do your hobby and you've got family and you've got friends and you've got a partner that you love, you want to spend time with all of them. Plus then, I mean, come on, there's Game of Thrones. I mean, how can you deny that? And everything costs time. And so the biggest question is, which price are you willing to pay? And that's the biggest question, is not do we have enough time? It's rather, what do we want to do with our time and what's important to you? And so for me, sleep is more important, because when I get sleep, I can actually be more productive during the day. And so you've heard of that law, I think it's called Pareto's principle, where however much time you dedicate to something is how much time it'll take to actually achieve the task. Now, the quality of that task will change like dramatically based on your developed skill with those particular tools. Like I've been learning the last year how to use video editing software. And so in the beginning, it took me 3 hours to do what now would take me 20 minutes easily. And then let's say if I gave myself a task like saying, I have to produce a high quality advert for myself in the next 20 minutes, how could that be done? What would that look like? And then focusing on polishing those things up. I mean, that's ultimately where this conversation goes, this principle of what do we want to fill our time with? Now, myself, I found that I operate better with more sleep. The studies show that actually oversleeping is more of a problem. It actually will degrade your mind permanently, which is a very interesting task. Sleep deprivation, same thing, but we can usually repay sleep debt. So I completely hand over everything to the experts on the topic. I have my own thoughts. I've done a lot of reading on sleep. Who's read books on sleep, right? Well, I've read about 5 or 6 different books on the specialist topic of sleeping, talking about units of sleep and what phases of sleep are more beneficial, and do you do biphasic or polyphasic or monophasic sleep? You know, I've done my own experiments as well. And then, of course, diet and how, you know, being in ketosis and fasted states influences sleeping. And yeah, my simple answer is that napping seems to be, for me, the more effective thing to develop. You actually, you can program your body and your mind to shut down at particular times for sleep. Like just through habit, you will develop and become a nighttime person or a morning person. If you tell your body to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, after a few weeks, it'll naturally wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning. But the key is to be consistent.
Mm.
And so your body will naturally adapt. But if you're constantly changing the times that you go to bed and the times that you wake up, you're not giving your body a chance to adapt. And so you'll constantly feel like you're somehow behind. You're not quite rested. So being well rested comes down to, well, are you consistent? And then after mm-hmm. that, you can fine tune those factors of like, well, you know, turning off your blue lights, reducing coffee at certain times, or not eating carbs at night, or I don't know, whatever you find effective for you. I found it particularly effective to actually have cold exposure, like cold showers right before bed. I sleep like a log if I have that.
Oh.
But that's deep sleep. So if you're somebody who's investigating lucid dreaming and more like those sleep protocols to actually have more REM sleep, then that's a bad thing, because you're not going to have any REM, whatever. You know, it's going to go straight into deep sleep, and you'll just wake up after having blacked out and feeling like you're in some kind of sleep coma, which is great. You know, you'll feel rested, but you'll also be like, oh, I didn't get a chance to practice dreaming. And so my answer, again, I'll come back to it, is the nap. Mastering the art of napping. And so for anyone who's interested, I would highly recommend coffee naps, which is, if you can, drinking mm-hmm. a cup of coffee. And what you'll find is, just before you go to bed and you sleep 20 minutes, your coffee will kick in. Plus the actual the hormone that induces sleep, I think it's called, if I'm not mistaken, it's called adenosine. Adenosine.
Melatonin.
No, it's not melatonin. Sorry, I've got my housemate whispering. Oh, it's not melatonin. Mm-hmm. Something else. Anyway, it's the one that coffee actually gets in the place of its receptor. But what happens is your sleep cleans that out. You don't feel as drowsy anymore. The caffeine comes in, wakes you up. And so you wake up after 20 minutes and just feel fantastic. But that 20 minutes is enough to actually have a great effect on your learning. There's been a couple of studies done on this. You know, as much as you trust studies. But yeah. It's definitely a personalized thing to play with. It's a very, very good thing, yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I'm going to try that. So just drink a cup of coffee and then go for a nap immediately afterwards.
Mm. And you know what, as a separate tip, what I'd also recommend is I have something that I call my lullaby album. And imagine it kind of like, you know, if you've seen The Avengers with the Hulk, mm-hmm. Him and Black Widow have got that thing where he says, "Sun's getting real low there, big guy," you know, and then he'll come out of his Hulk state or whatever. Mm. There's a certain lullaby that you can have as well. My album is, I don't know if you're familiar with a band called Massive Attack.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did an album called Protection. The entire album, I think, plays through. It's about 40 minutes long. And it is just such soothing, calming, but also mesmerizing. It's kind of got this binaural beats type of thing happening. I don't know if they planned mm-hmm. that or if it's just me. But I love that album. And I play that. And whenever I put it on and I'm lying down, by song two or three, I'm in a sleep state. I'm gone.
Hmm.
By about song 7 or 8, my brain starts to wake up a little bit, and I lie in bed until I listen to the end of the album. By the end of the album, I'm up again and I'm out. And so sounds like that, especially the combination of sounds with lights down and everything else turned off and you lying in a certain position, you actually start to tell your body, this is time to nap. And when the sounds disappear, this is time to get up. And again, it's something that's really worth developing if it takes you about 3 weeks to develop a lullaby album, because then without the coffee, you can also click into that state quite easily.
Mm, I love that. That's such a cool one.
Mm.
On the topic of these kind of rituals, are there any, I'm curious what your kind of daily routine or like, so you've mentioned lullaby album, coffee naps, and then cold exposure before bed. Are there any other kind of daily practices or practices you just do every couple of weeks that you find really useful for like learning, but also just like life and well-being in general?
Sure. Whew. there's so many that are coming to mind because I live with two people, my girlfriend and my best friend. They're fanatical about things like infrared sauna to detoxify and feel great, you know, regular exercise, but also sensitization to your muscles. I think one of the biggest things that I do is try to get in some not movement or exercise, but connecting with the muscles. You hear bodybuilders talk about a mind-muscle connection. And so just contracting my muscles and actually paying attention, like I'm contracting my bicep and not other things around it. I'm contracting my tricep and not anything else. That's something that I do very regularly, and it actually has a great effect on me. A lot of people talk about light exposure and getting out into the sun. You know, like I'm a bit of a vampire. I don't really need it. I haven't found it affects me that much. I don't suffer like winter or seasonal, what do they call it? SAD, seasonal affective disorder. I don't really get that. I know in Canada, people obviously, you know, the winters come and the night is long and filled with horror, I suppose, Game of Thrones would say. But my particular routines are, I try to find something, information that I consume at least once a week. I'll try to find a new idea. When I read a book, there's normally one or two key concepts in there for me to chew on. So one of my practice is a consumption of a particular idea that I had no exposure to before. After that, I would say a stillness practice. That stillness could be just sitting down for 15 minutes and just doing nothing. There's nothing on around me. There's nothing to do. I just have to sit for 15 minutes and let things settle. And then on top of that, like meditation is absolutely a stillness practice as well. So I'll have a consumption practice, I'll have a stillness practice, and then I'll have a productive practice. And what that productive practice looks like changes. So I'll try to make something that I've never made before in the kitchen, like cooking keto brownies or something like that. Or perhaps I'll make a video. And so cycling between this harmony of consumption, production, and stillness is something that I find to be greatly effective. And of course, it looks very differently. With my body, it's those types of connections and movements, but I find playing with cold exposure to be one of the best things. So even if that means walking around without a jumper on or a top on and just a t-shirt in mildly cold weather and challenging myself. And then the final one is, if anyone's read the book, The Oxygen Advantage, it's a fantastic read. And that particular breathing technique focuses on holding the exhale of your breath to have a buildup of carbon dioxide in the body. And then so the body could actually make better use of the oxygen, because we're always oxygenated. The way that we breathe, we have almost like an overabundance of oxygen in the bloodstream at any one time. And people can measure this by getting yourself a blood oximeter, which is like, I think, $20 or $30 on Amazon. And you can see for yourself, your blood oxygen levels are usually very high. As they need to be. When they drop down to a certain point, they become dangerous, but they almost never drop down to those points with regular breath work and breathing. And so I practice regularly exhaling, holding that exhale, and then doing work for as long as I can until I feel that compulsion to breathe, and then letting in that particular breath very slowly, very deliberately. And so breathing practice is what I would recommend that people definitely look into. There's a strong correlation with over oxygenation and actually almost a negative effect on the brain, which is quite interesting. Yeah, and it's nose breathing versus mouth breathing. There's a lot of topics to cover when it comes to breathing as well. So it's like sleeping and breathing, two things that people do naturally, but actually there are systems and entire intricate worlds beyond them that can actually really help to add quality to life and also a lot of productivity to things. So yeah,
I love the way that you categorize these practices as like consumption practices, stillness practices, and productive practices. That's such a cool way to categorize them that I've never considered before. I love that.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I mean, and when you think about it, I think the biggest question is like, personally, what is a stillness practice for you? I mean, John, do you have a particular answer? You know, like what would you say would be your stillness time where you're not doing anything, you're not consuming or producing, you're just being?
So I'm always trying to figure out like what's the best way to, because I love the kind of different kind of practices for personal growth, and I'm always trying to figure out what order to put them in, and where I can slot my reading, you know, whether I should listen to an audiobook or read a book on my Kindle on my phone. And I want to ask you a little bit more about reading in a minute, but
sure.
My stillness practice, I have two of them. One of them is just meditation. I use Sam Harris's Waking Up app for meditation,
right?
Which I really like. And then the other one is just stretching, but like in a very slow with deep breathing stretching, like just hanging in one pose for a few minutes at a time. Those two, yeah, I find very, very nice stillness practices for me.
Nice, cool. I find that like the type of practice that comes with physical stillness as well, like you say, like hanging in a pose and overcoming that, you know, that's a great stillness practice. I was going to say the thing that jumped into my mind with you is perhaps after jiu-jitsu, you know, you take that, what's it called, the hero pose, where you sit on your heels, bent knees. It's almost like the Japanese prayer position. And just being in stillness after like rolling or after practicing that type of art, just closing your eyes and focusing on your breath work as a way to calm down, like taking control of your excited states and calming them down, and then your calm states and hyping them up and practicing your ability to actually induce your own chosen state. You know, those types of things are fantastic as well. So like you can even exercise, how can I get hyped up? How can I calm down? How quickly can I do that? And I find that to be very, very effective. But it comes into this stillness practice, and where do you place stillness practice? Or, okay, cool, productivity, and where do you place it? Like placing it just after stillness is a great way to do it as well. You know, your stillness is kind of like your baseline, I think.
I'm going to definitely do what you just suggested, because usually after practice, it's just you're hot, sweating, you just want to, like, everyone is rushing to get out of there, to get in the car, to drive home,
right,
and just taking a few minutes to just stop, get into that pose and just be still. I can see a lot of benefit from doing that, so yeah. I'm gonna give that a go.
Yeah, it'll
make
activate
it part of my routine.
It'll activate a lot of those neural pathways we were talking about, where just settling, your brain will naturally cycle through everything that you've just been through as well, quite nicely. And it just gives a time. And if you decide to take a more active role in your mind while you're sitting in that stillness, you can decide, okay, I've got, you know, 10 minutes of stillness before I need to go. Let me just remember everything that I've gone through. What was an idea that was great? What was a particular like sequence that I learned that I really enjoyed? Or which one did I hate? Why did I hate that? Why did I? And just asking a lot of these questions and asking yourself to just run through the last 15, 20 minutes in your mind is a fantastic way to reinforce that memory as well. And it's still part of that stillness practice, but I mean, it's one type. So when we talk about learning, I always give people this particular thing to think about, umbrella terms. So happiness is not one defined thing. It's an umbrella term for many of the definitions of what happiness is. So you've got like reflective happiness, you've got daily happiness. And so learning is the same thing. It's an umbrella term. Memory, it's the same thing. It's an umbrella term. You know, when we talk about learning, we can talk about physical skill acquisition. You can talk about learning university, learning a speech. And each one of them takes slightly different protocols. You know, when you talk about stillness practice as well, now we can talk about stillness as an umbrella term, meditation as an umbrella term, because everybody will tell you that meditation for them is one thing or a different thing or a different thing. And if we understand the spectrum of what these are, and we can investigate which one do we enjoy, which one works well for us, which one will take effort to develop enjoyment, which one will just is a natural inclination for us to enjoy. And so each one of them. So like I hate guided meditations. I can't stand them. I prefer to be a lot more active or personal. So one of my favorite meditations is actually, we did a thing at an event I went to where people sat around and they basically tell you what they admire about you. And these are people that are my friends. And so actually just listening to that is an incredibly validating experience. And even though like the effect wears off over time, you don't do it every day. You do it like once a month. And it's just a nice way to remember that actually I am valued. you know, where other times our social insecurities may get the better of us. And so my favorite types are more personal and more active types of meditation. But that's only one type of stillness anyway. And so remembering that stillness is an umbrella term, and what it looks like for each person can be different and should also be explored by that person. So yeah, I'd love to hear your exploration into it and what it comes back to be.
One of the other areas of learning I was curious to get your ideas on is this idea of sort of like when you learn something, then becoming the teacher of that thing you learned. So like if you read a book, I've heard that it's good practice to integrate what you learn to go out into the world and talk about what you've read, just to teach someone. Is that accurate?
It's pretty much what you're referring to was a study that was done at I believe it was the Maine University of Maine. It's called the Pyramid of Retention Rates. You know, if you just lecture to someone, they'll retain maybe 10%, I think the study found, and then after that, you know, depending on the model, I actually have a model right here. Depending on each one of these different things, you would get a different response. And so the epitome of that, of course, the pinnacle, comes down to, oh, you will retain a lot more if you teach it. And of course, you know, studies being what they are, there's always going to be flawed methodology in studies because as a human, you know, we can't take away our observer bias. It's almost impossible to take that away. Now, saying that, oh, there we go. I've got it now. It's the, National Training Laboratories in Bethnal, Maine. They made famous this pyramid of the average learner retention rates. Lecturing, you'll retain 5%. Reading, 10%. Audiovisual, 20%. Great. Demonstration, 30%. Discussion groups, 50%. Practice by doing, 75%. Teaching others, 90%. So everyone just naturally says, great. If I teach others, 90%. That's fantastic. Let me go into that teacher position. Now, the reason why this works is because in our brains, facilitating a lot of this is the natural way that our brain works. So our social part of our brain is what works. And the social part of our brain is wired to prefer stories. Mm-hmm. The social part of our brain is vying for social validation, social status. And so teaching others automatically places us above others. Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. By showing others what we know, we get validation. Fantastic. So if you tell somebody to teach another person what they've just learned, sometimes you'll get that that because they might not be that confident in themselves, they will be forced into it and they won't want to do it. Or alternatively, they will overcompensate and they will start to make up stuff that they haven't learned. They will start to autocomplete as a way of, if they don't know the answer to something, they don't want to seem stupid in front of social groups. So right. The teaching others thing becomes a little bit precarious. You know, we need to be careful with that. An easy remedy for that is to approach it with an idea. So I like to get a lot of my clients to make videos where they are demonstrating the skill that they've developed, explaining what they've done, what they've learned, and then teaching others after that. So that the teaching thing comes last, the demonstration comes first, and then we start to separate out social validity. If I can demonstrate I can do it, then I get the validity there, not by teaching you. By teaching you, I'm just sharing information. But by demonstrating, I'm actually fine. Okay, I'm showing my value and I'm showing how much developed skill I have as well. So demonstration becomes a big deal. Teaching becomes a big deal, but then also a reporting. So those are the three protocols that I follow. So it's not just teaching others. And then by sharing, by reporting back to people, you also put yourself in a position where other people are almost invited to participate because they're almost like they're the boss and you're reporting to them. This type of thing creates a discussion. Social engagement of the particular topic allows you to investigate, whereas if I'm teaching you, There's no investigation. I am the authority. That's the end of the story. And then we create power struggles and things like that. So I tend to recommend to people to rather start the discussion. And so a lot of the people that I've coached with learning and studying, the postgraduates, getting a study group together and actually having social discussions and social debates about what interests them or what confuses them about the topic. And then, even if there's nobody to teach, creating a video where they demonstrate, report, and then teach what they just learned as a way of actually almost revising what they've done. And then you can delete that video. You don't need to do anything with that video, but just the fact that you've actually explained it and recorded it as if you were talking to someone is enough to activate the physical mind, the social mind, and all of these other parts of our neuropsychology that comes into play when we learn.
I love that. Yeah, okay. So there's a little bit of a trap in just going off and teaching someone.
Exactly.
Because you could autocomplete.
Yeah.
But the demonstrating first on video, I think that is something that could also be applied to jiu-jitsu as well, perhaps, you know, like teaching a particular technique on video, demonstrating it and then going off and teaching it would help like integrate the technique. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. You know, definitely, as humans, you know, demonstrating and seeing something, you know, especially if it's another human, demonstrating a skill, a physical skill, it's mirror neurons kicking in again, you know. And if I'm allowed to, while I'm watching you do it, like move my body and see if I can actually make the shapes with my body that you are making, I'm mirroring you and I'm actually practicing while you're demonstrating. That type of thing is very interesting. And when people talk about teaching, you know, teaching again, teaching is an umbrella term. What exactly is teaching? Being a language teacher, people expected me to talk about grammar for hours at a time, where actually the explanation itself, I found, was 5 minutes. Show an example, explain how it works and be very clear, field any questions, and then it's like, great, do you understand? Yes. Is it clear? Yes. Awesome. Why is it that you can't use it then? Oh, I just forget it in the moment. No, it's not to do with anything about understanding. It's just to do with developed practice. So I find that teaching, the best form of teaching, is actually facilitating other people's practices, managing their initial contact with whatever it is, with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu technique, with the initial data point, with the initial sentence structure, whatever it is. I manage their practice. So I'm like, okay, cool. Let's try and do the sequence together, like one sentence or one sequence. Oh, that's too much. Okay, let's reduce the intensity by 2, by 5. Let's reduce the amount that I'm asking you to do by half, and then working that half and then working the next half. And so good teaching for me is actually about clear explanations and then facilitating other people's practice. And that's it. And then teaching them to actually drill it with that 80% skill focus, where you're reconstructing something from your brain and facilitating it into your muscles.
That's powerful. Yeah. I want to switch to the topic of reading for a moment.
Sure.
Many of our listeners love reading lists and love reading. Primarily, yeah. Books on personal growth, trauma healing, spirituality, and philosophy as well. You mentioned earlier in the episode that sitting down and being kind of lifeless and reading a book is not an optimal way to read. So, two questions. What is the best way to read and retain what you've learned and sort of integrate it and embody it? And then after that, I would love to hear some of the books that you've read that have resonated with you the most.
Okay. Remind me to, when I talk about the books, I have a question for you. So I'm going to stick that in my mind for now.
Okay.
The very simple thing has got to do with what do you want? When you're reading, what do you want? And a lot of people are seduced by this idea nowadays as well about being the most efficient reader, and so speed reading techniques. But speed reading techniques don't guarantee comprehension. As many people as I've met who say, oh, I can read 1,000 words a minute, I can show you just as many studies that show that more than 450 or 500 words a minute, and there's no more comprehension. So that person was actually only comprehending about 50% of what they were reading anyway. But I could show you just as many statistics about books that show that 90% of books is just filler information. And it's quite interesting. It comes back to this. There's a mechanism in the mind of autocomplete that's actually a very physical thing. It's not even an abstract notion. When we talk about flicker rates of screens, you know, and people are like, oh, I'm not going to get a 4K screen. Why would I get that? I don't need a high flicker rate. My brain doesn't actually pick it up. It's like your physical eye actually picks it up. And even though there would be darkness, your brain will actually link it together. A higher flicker rate will actually make you tired faster. It'll actually tire out your eyes because your eyes actually have to autocomplete information, even though perceivably you don't notice a difference. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the brain and we talk about reading, especially reading material that you are very familiar with, reading material that is you trying to extract knowledge from it, you will have an autocomplete mechanism that you can totally develop to read faster. And so that's where speed reading works very well on nonfiction. You know, you're literally like a gold prospector panning for gold. And what you're doing is you're just sifting through information, establishing context. So you've got to these different muscles in your brain to develop as well, like your context recognition. Like, I've worked with people who are fantastic at learning, but their actual contextualization muscle is terrible. So when you ask them to contextualize something, it's such a struggle for them to do it, even though they hold advanced degrees. So these are just all different muscles in the mind and how we express them. But coming back to the reading idea, optimal reading ultimately is not necessarily that. It's about understanding what is your baseline and then how do I increase my baseline. So if your baseline is that you can read one page before you become distracted, then I say go for that. Read your one page and then purposefully distract yourself to then think about what you just read. So an example of this is there's a very famous book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb called The Black Swan, you know, which is that it's not the crazy ballerina. It's the book about mathematical probability and risk management. Sorry. He wrote the book Anti-Fragile as well, which is quite popular. And yeah, that book, I could have read that very fast, but what I chose to do rather was consume that book very slowly. I decided to do the opposite. Anti-speed reading, if you will, slow reading. Think about the way that you eat food. You can choose to eat food very quickly, but the mechanisms that you have in your body for digestion work better when it's slower. There's a great book out there called Mindless or Mindful Eating.
Yeah.
I think it's called Mindless Eating. Yeah, yeah. And same thing. Like, why is it that people report higher levels of satisfaction and fullness after eating soup, but the same thing, the same level of nutrition or the same level of same quantity of food in a smoothie doesn't fill them up as much. They still report being a little bit hungry after a smoothie. And people say, oh, it's the temperature. And they tested out the temperature, and it's actually not the temperature. It's actually the rate of which you consume that food. So imagine now that instead of drinking your smoothie, imagine eating your smoothie with a spoon, like you would a soup, and you'd actually experience a high level of satisfaction and fullness after that. Now, let's transfer slow food and slow eating to the same thing of consumption of information when we come to reading. If you consume information very quickly, it actually doesn't digest as well in your mind. And so what we start to do is sift for that one nutrient in that food that's going to make the difference to us. Whereas consuming something a lot slower, you'll start to find that it starts to be more impactful. And so I was reading The Black Swan. I was reading one page at a time, and I would stop for 10 minutes, and I would think about that page, and I would ponder that page. And of course, I found myself sitting in a coffee shop drinking coffee and also people watching and just letting that page sit with me for 10 minutes. And I found that that book and that experience of reading that book was one of my most pleasurable reading experiences that I can recall. which is incredible. Wow. To think about it.
Yeah.
And I also give people a very quick demonstration of these types of things, like reading lists. I mean, I'm a fan. I'm a huge fan. You know, the top 10 classic works of arts, you know, of literature that you should read before you die. I'm like, oh, I got to read these books. And I never get around to them. And ultimately, it's because of my habits. It's nothing to do with my reading culture. It's just got to do with, well, I'm busy. And the price I pay for developing a business is that I don't have time to read. Or the price I pay for exercising is that I prioritize my exercising over my reading. So speed reading kicks in. Great. The books that I speed read, I find that I'm confirming a lot more information that I have. And you get that confirmation bias. So if we talk about the best ways to read, I would say read stuff that's not on your list. I would say read stuff that people would never recommend to you, because they would not connect it with you. Because the stuff that they probably would connect it with you, you're probably, especially when we're talking about nonfiction, you're probably very familiar already with these concepts. You're probably already familiar with a lot of the ideas that are in there, and it's confirming them for you, which is great. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's where speed reading kicks in, and you could probably just confirm that a lot faster. And if you wanted to go into more depth and more detail, like, I want to recall a lot more of this. Like, I understand the basic idea, but I want a lot more of the details. Consume it with a notebook and pen right next to you. Even if you throw that notebook and pen away after you've finished that one reading session, just the fact of going to your notebook and writing down a key idea. There's so many studies that show writing notes makes you consolidate information in your own words. Drawing pictures is almost as, you know, like, as impactful as teaching others, because by drawing a picture to show how a dynamic actually interacts means that you need to be clear on it in your own mind. And so the studies that show that using your hand, writing notes, drawing pictures, if people are interested, they can research the Feynman technique. And there's a fantastic YouTuber, Thomas Frank. I love his stuff. He goes a little bit too nerdy for me sometimes, and a little bit too orientated around the data. But he's fantastic, and he's well aware of himself. As a learner, I really like him. And he's got a great video on the Feynman technique. So if people want to look at that, that's great as well. And I would actually say every time you consume a YouTube video that you want to pay attention to, you want to recall more at the end, write it down. A podcast that you're listening to, you want some notes. Well, actually write notes, draw pictures while you're listening. That way you recall more. And then just take 5 minutes of stillness at the end and ask yourself, what were the main points that you got excited about while you were consuming this thing? You know, if it was so important, you probably stopped consuming to write it down. But at the end, you finish your consumption and recall as much as possible. Like, what did I enjoy? What was there? What did I read? Asking yourself those questions, just, you know, again, it helps those neural pathways to connect.
So I think what you've just shared are you've shared a few ideas, but the two ones of having some stillness after you consume something, and also keeping a notebook handy when you have information that you really want to integrate and isn't just confirmation bias type material that you could skim read.
Exactly.
Those two things are incredibly simple. Like, everyone can do that now. Everyone can get a notebook, get a pen, and make the habit of having a few minutes of stillness after they consume something, even an episode of their favorite podcast or a YouTube video or an article or a book. And I'm definitely going to be doing that now. Because it's so easy. I just hope that people listening will also take that step, because the amount of self-discipline required is quite small, and I think the benefit that you could gain if you spent the rest of your life doing this, the richness of information that you could gain and wisdom would be quite incredible compared to if you didn't do that.
Absolutely. There's one quick hack as well for people who are reading on their phones or on their tablets or something like that. Maybe a notebook and a pen isn't available or something. Another idea is to take a screenshot of whatever it is you're reading. And then when you finish reading, close your eyes, have your stillness anyway. And then after your stillness, just actually review the screenshots that you took and try and find that the reason why you took that screenshot in the first place. Where's that sentence that really triggered you, that really inspired you, or that was a, you know, something that you really wanted to remember? So cycling through screenshots if you don't have a notebook. But definitely, I'm sure you can see that the screenshot, you're not doing as much physical work. You're not actually creating something on paper. You're just literally pushing a button. It's a lot less effective, but it still is a quick hack just in case you don't have notebook and pen ready. So it's just removing all those excuses of like, well, I can't do it because I don't have my notebook. Well, cool, screenshot it. And then you've actually got something that you can reread later as well, like reminder or reinforce that neural pathway, as we said.
Mm. Just one, before we switch to like some books, I want to ask you, one of my favorite philosophers is Seneca, and he had quite a lot to say on reading. Like one of his ideas was that you shouldn't just like jump around from author to author. You should instead find the best author and just really get to know their ideas and read and reread and read and reread.
Yeah.
And he kind of like didn't have he used this phrase notebook knowledge, and he said that people with notebook knowledge, it was kind of like a waste to have that kind of knowledge. And I've encountered some people, they've read a lot of books and they've taken lots of notes, but it seems like everything they say is just something from this notebook knowledge. Mm. And they have very few of their own ideas. When I speak to you, I get a sense that you're quite balanced in that you're very well educated, but you also you kind of question things and have your own perspectives.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas for how you can kind of avoid that trap of just being this like reservoir of other people's ideas that you've just jotted down in notebooks?
So it's I love the question, by the way, John. It's a fantastic point. The topic that it brings up with me is it's called model thinking. It's got its basis in complex systems analysis, or what's called systems theory, which is this idea that, let's say, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, a child, when you're explaining the world to a child, they've been introduced to the world with simple yes or no, right and wrong kind of stimulus, right? I want this. Okay, well, we'll try to get this, but there are many conflicting factors that would mean that maybe you can't have that toy that you want. And the child gets upset, but I wanted that toy, but you didn't give me that toy. And the child doesn't understand. Mainly because the mental model that they've got says, if X, then Y, if Y, then Z. You know, it's this linear thinking, this model of just there's two options. Get it or don't get it. If I get it, I'm happy. If I don't get it, I'm upset. Now, we upgrade our thinking as we move along. We become more complex in how the world works. This complexity of thought then becomes very tiring if we have to always think about all of these little factors all the time. You ask anyone who's done any research into like nutrition and exercise that it's a bottomless pit of data and information and perspectives and viewpoints, and you're like, oh my God, where does it end? Now, when we come back to this particular topic about reading and questioning and not becoming like a notebook warrior, it comes back to model thinking. And so the models that I have is basically to challenge everything. And so whenever I like something that an author puts forward, I'm like, oh, this is a confirmation bias. If I like it, it's confirming what I already know. How could this be wrong? So it's just something that comes back up with regard to a thought practice. And rather, instead of a habit of reading or a stillness habit, it's a thought habit that you have. You know, a voice in your head that you just need to practice this muscle of asking this question of, how does that work? No, but how is this connected? Or how is this linked? What is it linked to? How can it affect things? And just asking a few of those questions in your reflection and in your stillness allows you to integrate that deeper. You don't need to have any profound thoughts at all. But a quick way is just to ask yourself is, how is this relevant to me? How does this change my life? How does it influence the people around me? So I used to be a huge conspiracy theorist. You want to talk about like 9/11, if you want to talk about you know, the moon landings and stuff like that, and lizard men and Atlantis, and like, I was game. I was absolutely game. But the more I researched, the more I realized that I was living my life in a particular way. And one question transcended all of my time spent looking into conspiracy theories and all my frustrations and all my anxiety around them. This question transcended it. And this question was very simple. Even if this turns out to be true tomorrow, do I still have to wake up, brush my teeth, go to my job, see my friends and family, live my life? And if the answer was yes, then it wasn't a relevant question. It wasn't a relevant topic to really look into. So I think the question of how does this affect me, how does this influence me, is a bigger one. So imagine chemtrails, and chemtrails are true. Surprise! You know, we find out that airplanes have been spreading poison. Well, cool. How does that influence me? Can I do anything about it? What would I do? Well, I'm going to die just as soon as the person next to me. So if that's the case, then what can I do to enjoy my life more today? Well, it's not worry about chemtrails, or be mindful of chemtrails, or participate in protests about chemtrails, and it will make you, you know, like a little bit more balanced for it. Now, if we're reading information, it's the same thing. Let's say I read information about crystals. I'm like, wow, that's great. Crystals do this. Okay, well, how can I integrate that into my life, or how does it change my life? So, I mean, people talk about the subtlety of crystals, but I would talk more about things that are organic and not mineral. Because a plant in your house or a dog in your house will have a lot more effect than a crystal in your house. And so those types of things of how does it affect my life? Well, a crystal is meant to give you good energy. Well, any dog or cat owner will tell you that just seeing them the first time that they wake up is going to give them a hell of a lot more of a smile than a crystal will. You know, which ultimately will affect your quality of life a lot more. And so, very simply, just coming back to this idea of having a thought habit, of a question of how do I integrate this, or what effect will this have in my life, is just something that allows you to get away from that and personalize it. And ultimately understanding, coming back to the brain again, notebook warriors typically are trying to just be socially valuable. That's all that they're trying to do. They're trying to show, hey, I know about this topic. I read XYZ. What they're trying to say is, I have value. Please value me. And unfortunately, that's just like a non-developed social skill. The best way to socially connect with people is to show, oh, I don't know about this. Please tell me more. You've read something about this? What did you think? Not, here's my interview, tell me more about this topic, but rather, how did you see this personally come about in your life? Tell me about your life as well. Those personal connections help a lot more. And so by personally connecting with data, you actually find a much more richness in it as well as a human being, and then as a social animal too, which it becomes very interesting. Like, I mean, who's got a favorite sequence of 10 numbers, you know? The people that I've helped memorize pi to 100 digits, because of the way that we memorize it, it's very personal that you actually find that you've got a favorite sequence of numbers. Like mine is the 582097494459, which is numbers 50 through to 60. It's actually, 50 to 59. Those nine numbers are some of my favorite numbers in that group. And I can explain why, but just, you know, think about how absurd that is, that you've got a favorite set of numbers. And I'm smiling as I'm saying this because, number one, it's absurd. But number two is they make me smile. These numbers make me smile. So, yeah. Coming back to your point, if I answered your question in a roundabout way, but trying to link it to all these other topics, it's just very simple. A notebook warrior is just someone trying to be socially valuable. Number one, with the data, ask how it impacts them personally as a person. And as a result of that, it impacts their identity a lot more. And the result is that their personality will affect their social quality as well. And they'll cease to be that type of person, perhaps with that stigma of being, the person who knows everything but doesn't necessarily implement it. Now, if I've answered that, going back to the point of exploring one author versus several authors, if we're talking about nonfiction, the opinion that I read that I really resonate with, it was a It was an article in The Economist, I believe. It was years ago. It was about a decade ago. And this person said that every author will have maximum of two incredible, fundamental, paradigm-shifting ideas in their life. And they will probably write about these in six or seven books. These two, three ideas again and again and again and again and again. And really just expanding on that, because those are the ideas that light them up. Because the Renaissance painters at the time, you know, were involved in multiple different things. They had impacts in multiple different industries. And so they had cross-pollination, and so they were able to stay relevant, come up with new ideas, things like that. But think about painters like Picasso. Picasso was really famed for one style of painting. Right, before he went into his particular style that everyone can identify as Picasso, which was actually not his. He was blending, I believe it was West African masks into abstract painting. You know, the styles of there, he was combining two, which brings in this other question of what is creativity. But before that, he was an established painter in completely different things. Like, try and look at the history of Picasso's works, and you'll find that in the beginning, he wasn't identifiable any more than anyone else could be. Now, when you think about that, and you think about cross-pollination, you think about Picasso's impact on the world was huge, but it was actually just one thing. Now, if you think about authors and writers, you can think, okay, maybe we'll put the roof at five separate ideas. But still, exploring that one author's thoughts, how do they think about the world to arrive at that one idea, comes back to jiu-jitsu. Not do I get him in the armbar, but how do I arrive at the armbar? There are hundreds of ways that you could arrive at that final lock. And so I find the idea interesting. And then after that, I find, how do they arrive at that idea? So when people tell me spoilers in movies, I'm not worried. I'm not fussed. I don't care. Because how do I arrive at that point that they've just spoiled? That's the interesting point. Who knew about that point? How big of a surprise really was it? I'm interested in the build-up as well as the payoff. And so, I like staying with one author. But after two or three books, or rather two or three presentations of their thought process, let's say, I can start predicting how they're going to arrive at the big points.
Right.
And so that's what I would switch author, I would say.
Well, I think that also to be considered in your answer as well is that you likely read very deeply and, you know, with a lot of comprehension, whereas the average reader might take longer to absorb the gems from a particular author.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just established muscles. I mean, I consumed so much nonfiction for you know, the better part of a decade as well, and so it's just a faster read for me. But when you talk about literature, it's a very slow read for me, you know. And that's because I developed that muscle where I want to read very deliberately. If I'm consuming Moby Dick, for example, the slower that you go, the more that you appreciate the wordplay. Like Herman Melville, I'm not too sure about that particular one. But the way that the construction of the sentence goes is that in English we typically say things like, is this crown that I wear too heavy? Where he organized it, is this crown too heavy that I wear? Because that was the style of the day. And just being able to read slower, you don't just see the idea, you also see the words that communicate the idea. And so paying attention to literature like that, it excites me. Now, I connect with that. Now, another person might not. But because I've exercised this intricacy muscle, like you say, this very deliberate muscle, it means that literature for me is a slower read, where other people would probably read faster than I do, you know. And poetry, definitely. When I read poetry, I'll read a 5-line poem in 30 minutes, where I will sit and chew those lines up, and you know, really exercise my muscles of like, why did this person think like this? And so it's just a developed muscle And everything has their my girlfriend would say, their light and shadow side, you know. There's a concept called the weakness of strength. And so what some people might admire in one way turns out to be a weakness in the other. So I'm very deliberate, I'm very complex, and I'm very drawn out with information and data and process. And while that's great talking about these topics and for my business as a learning expert and what I do and how I do it, it's amazing. But you put me at a party and I can't make small talk with most people. It becomes very difficult for me to talk. So I've become exercised at asking people questions that makes them share their life with me. But when I share my life with them, it's very difficult not to just, you know, let those muscles kick in and just start talking about these incredibly complex topics, which shut most people down, where they shy away and they're like, oh, you're one of those people. I'm going to get a drink from the bar. Please excuse me. Bye. You know. So, yeah.
Well, I think that you would definitely be one of my people if I started talking to you in a party.
Nice. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely with a Brazilian jiu-jitsu angle. I'm sure that you and I would probably be like talking about demonstrating moves after 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I wanted to ask you as well, since we're still on the topic of reading.
Sure.
What are some of the books that have resonated with you the most? And they can be about learning, but just anything in general, because I think our listeners now have got a sense of who you are and would just be very curious what books you love the most.
Ooh, it's a great question. Okay, I think I come back to... Let me categorize it then and say the works of Tim Ferriss, you know, The 4-Hour Workweek, The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Chef, Tools of Titans, you know, Tribe of Mentors, like all of them. I consumed each one of those books at least 7 times.
Wow.
And his goal was to make a generation of people who are learners that are better than him. And I would say I'm one of those generation where... Without him, I don't think I would be, you know, focusing the direction that I am. And so definitely as a starting point, I mean, I can't recommend him highly enough. I completely disagree with a lot of his methodologies now that I've investigated them on my own. But I think without him, you know, none of this would exist. It's kind of like if you watch Usher dance, you're like, wow, he dances so well and he dances better than Michael Jackson. But you know what? Without Michael Jackson, Usher wouldn't exist. It's that simple.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And yeah, so Tim Ferriss is a big one for me. I think one of the best thought leaders that I have read is, like I mentioned, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Lebanese-American author, The Black Swan, The Bed of Procrastes, Fooled by Randomness was the other one. His new one is called Skin in the Game. They are incredible books. Incredible. Peter Diamandis did a book, Abundance, and I like that one because that challenges a lot of existing things as well. Yeah, I think those are my big ones. If I had to go for any others, it's really something that I'd have to look up and say, right. Oh, this one, and this one, and this one. Yeah, well, those are my big ones. Yeah,
I think those are more valuable because I mean, you could list like dozens of books that like you liked and you got something from, but I think that you've just listed a few books that you've read like at least 7 times. So
yeah.
I've read The 4-Hour Body and The 4-Hour Chef. Never read The 4-Hour Workweek, but now after speaking to you, I really want to dive into that very soon. And also Taleb's books as well. I've heard about them so many times, but I just haven't got around to them. So yeah, that's great. Thank you for that recommendation.
No problem. And you know, for those types of things, if people are like, okay, I want the idea, but I don't want the style of writing. Like George R.R. Martin's wrote Game of Thrones. I can't stand his actual style of writing. For me, it's horrible. I hated it. I made it through 2 books just by grinding my teeth. And but I love the series. And so consuming the same media, or rather I should say the same material, but with a different medium. So, for example, if you if you read some of Talib's books, it's thick. He's definitely an academic as much as he professes to not being an academic. He's so well read at such a high level, it comes across in his writing, the way he forms sentences. One of the best things that I can recommend to people is where other people reformulate what he says. So there's a great app called Blinkist. I believe there's another one, MentorBox, which is the same thing, where they summarize, you know, these huge books into short, like 15-page segments or something like that. But I like to consume a lot of media on YouTube, and I can consume it at a faster rate because I've got audio and visual stimulus. So I'll watch a video at like 1.75 speed that summarizes books that I want to read, but I just don't have time to read, especially with nonfiction, because they'll give you the big, big bullet point ideas. And then have some stillness after I've consumed that and just think, what do I want to... that's quite interesting. So that's another way that I work around, I don't have time to read. Cool. Watch a YouTube video where someone's reporting what they read. And YouTube channels is where I stick with the authors, you know, where I say this author, this particular YouTube channel has got great content. I like the way this person thinks. What are they going to do? Can I predict the way that they think? What new material can they present in their particular personal style?
I think that podcasts are amazing learning tools, and I think the way that we, the kind of natural, somewhat messy way that we speak naturally in a podcast, it actually lends itself to comprehension and attention. Because I've listened to, like, Jordan Peterson, for example. Yeah. I can listen to him on YouTube all day, but listening to his audiobook where he was reading a script was a completely different experience altogether.
Yeah, I mean, you know it's something like that, our tonality changes. It's the same thing. I try and make YouTube videos all the time, and I can't get excited talking to a camera. But if you put someone behind the camera asking me questions, you'll watch me come alive and my tone changes and everything. And so it's like, yeah, Jordan Peterson, same thing. You know, you put him in front of a microphone, he's probably bored himself. you know, but engaging with people, and you engage that social aspect, you'll watch people perform by engaging a social aspect. So yeah, it's very, very interesting stuff.
So we've covered a lot of ideas, and honestly, I could keep asking you questions, and I definitely want to have another conversation with you sometime in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, where we attack a specific topic together, and we can go really deep into the kind of structures of learning. But for people who are listening, and we've covered a lot of ground and so many useful ideas, I'd like to kind of wrap things up a bit, but first, like, where can people find out more about you, and also, like, work with you potentially, if that's what you do? I know you said you work with clients, so would love to hear more about that.
Absolutely. So at the moment, I'm currently in the final stages of developing a very quick memory course, and that's going to be available very soon on my website and on my Facebook page. I think the quick explanation for that is that people always want memory improvement techniques, but what they find out there are super expensive courses that are like 37 hours long, and I hate that idea. I'll give you the content in 5 minutes, and then we've got Facebook groups that facilitate you practicing that content, which is much more engaging anyway. So that's coming out now. It's called The 5 Memory Secrets. And then I work with people one-to-one in a variety of ways, but it's usually the way that I work is we do online calls. We run through a program of 3 months. So I do sometimes work with people when they do presentations, but I'm phasing that part out because I find that people don't try and develop presentation skills over time. They're just like, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble, I need help, and I'm not a first aider. So I like to work with people in development, and so I actually have a what I call the Brain Forge, which is a 12-week program to help change what is a brute force method of learning or acquiring information into a more elegant, efficient model. And so I run people through this 12-week program. So I've got a digital product. I've got the 12-month the 12-week program, and then after that, I'm happy to do consultations. So if anybody's listening, interested, and they're curious about how we can work together or something like that, I love taking calls and just adding value to people. At this point in time, a lot of what I do, a lot of what I'm about, is really establishing value. Because if I'm lit up, then I'm going to add more value to people, and I'm going to find more points of, okay, great, I can actually make a course about this, which is going to be beneficial to many, many, many people. So I'm still in this mode where I'd love to hear from everybody about what is it that they're interested in, and how we can actually consolidate a lot of these ideas into functioning, applicable things. So the other thing that I run then is some of these ideas on, you know, psychological biases and learning conditioning. I run workshops on those for retreats, online workshops as well. So yeah, various different little things, and I'm very interested to see just see what evolves. I've got an idea in the future for running a opening up a brain lab, which will be quite cool.
Nice. For everyone listening, I'm going to put links to everywhere that has been mentioned in the show notes, both in the High Existence article and also in the iTunes podcast show notes. So be sure to check the links there. Just a couple of questions. What kind of, like, for the 12-week program that you have, what typically are the type of skills or things people come to you to learn? Do you have any like major ones? I know language learning has got to be a big one.
Sure.
Anything else?
Yeah. So most people come to me for the memory techniques, speed reading, and accelerated learning patterns. And so what they do is they come out with those three things absolutely that they went in for. You know, their learning improves, they'll find greater retention. But then what I also add, which people don't normally look for, but they find great value in, it's one of those unknowns. They didn't know that they needed it, so they didn't know that it was out there, is model thinking and this psychological bias examination. And coming out of that, they become better communicators, and actually allows them to put information in a particular way which doesn't upset them. So we talk about inflammation in the body when you get injured. You can also talk about neurological or psychological inflammation when information comes in and it hurts you. Like, oh, I didn't think that person would do this action that actually hurts me. They betrayed me. That's based on a model of reality. And so by examining these models, you actually find people communicate better, they forgive easier, and they experience a lot less hurt, a lot less, you know, like I said, psychological inflammation, because they've just got a model that allows this thing to exist and still not be defiant of this. And so comfort as well, you know, they get over a lot of discomfort. So there's things like that.
I love that you have put a focus on cognitive bias. A few years ago I went through a period of really studying cognitive bias, read books like Predictably Irrational and Irrationality.
Dan Ariely is one of my favorite authors, actually, you know. But I consume a lot of his data on YouTube. I haven't read any of his books, but I've consumed like all of his talks and things like that on YouTube. He's great. I love him. Yeah.
Well, what I found when I made this dive into the world of irrational thinking is that it actually made me much smarter, and I was perceived as much smarter and wiser and more humble. And like, the reason why is because I just learned how stupid I could be, you know, and other people. It was like a kind of paradoxical insight.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, I'm not as smart as I thought I was. I make all these mistakes. Because I'm aware of that, you can rely on me more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's it exactly. But how many people, you know, have that type of knowledge, and just, you know, allowing space for that to exist as well. It's like, it's not a reflection on you. It's not that you are these things. It's like, well, this is how your brain works. And you think, so this is normal. Yeah, this is normal. Other people experience this very same thing. So yeah, I think that's a big deal. It's a big deal. Like, people forgiving themselves for being bad at math, for example, allows them to be great at math. after time. So yeah, it's a big deal. So although we're talking about cognition, it ties in with emotionality, it ties in with, like, you know, how you understand yourself as well, and allows you to achieve that higher existence, you know.
Yeah, well, this has been a great conversation. I've learned a lot and very inspired, and we've made it almost to 2 hours, so the episode will be over 2 hours when it's released. So yeah, thank you so much for your time and answering the questions and keeping the energy high for 2 hours. I appreciate it.
No, thank you very much, John. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and I'm looking forward to the next one. I'm full of energy and full of life, so thank you.
Great. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the High Existence Podcast. Remember, if you enjoyed listening to this, subscribe so that you get notified when all new episodes come out. And if you really like it, then we would appreciate it so much if you left a review and a comment on the podcast. It would help us keep the podcast going strong and would allow us to keep getting amazing guests on the show. Until next time, my friends.